This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
I would like to welcome to the Sub 70 podcast former All-American at Ohio State University and winner of the 2017 Puerto Plata Dominican Republic Open on the Latin American Tour, TK Kelly, to the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time today to be with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So how is your game currently shaping up, and what's your fall schedule going to look like for the rest of this year? And is Q School coming up, or what's sort of the game plan?
Yeah, it's like kind of right in the crunch time part of the year we're getting into now. First part of my game's feeling pretty good. I've been working pretty hard the last few months, and I've kind of had a weird season compared to last with my conditional status on the web. You know, I was trying to work my way into some of those events, playing a bunch of Monday qualifiers, and those can just be a little brutal. You know, I felt like I was playing pretty good all year, shooting a bunch of 67, 68s and not having them get me anywhere. Went out and played in Canada a little bit this summer, and again, felt like my game was turning in the right direction. I feel like I've gotten a lot better this year. Just didn't quite maybe see the results I was hoping to see up there. And just kind of came back the last couple of weeks and have still been working hard. I'm going to head to Brazil this weekend on Sunday for the first two Latin America events of the fall season, both in Sao Paulo, which will be fun. And then I come back, got about a week and a half off, then I have first stage. Then, you know, I'll head down to, I believe it is Lima, Peru, and Chile for two events, and then pop back up to the States and have about a week off before second stage. And then we'll kind of see, that'll take me to about the first week of November. So a little back and forth here for the next 2 months, but it'll be good to plan some events and get the ball rolling.
With your win last year, on the Latin American Tour, what exemption does that get you? Are you fully exempt through, say, 2019 if you so chose to play that tour full-time, or how does the exemption work with a victory?
It's a good question. You know, I'm pretty sure it's just for this season down there, but there is a past champion category that you can get into events off of, so I'm not exactly... Like, I don't think I'll have full status if I were the one to play down there next year. I think I could get into a couple of events off that past champion status and certainly get status exemptions, you know, if need be, and work my way, you know, in the full status that way. But I don't think it automatically gives me, you know, 2 years of status, like, say, a win on a tour would.
And talking about that win last year, you went really, really low the first, you know, a couple rounds. You had a huge lead after 54 holes, and then you finished it off. It has to be a real confidence builder to go out there, win at a high level early in your career. Comments on that week, or was it just one of those weeks where literally the cup looked like the size of a basketball hoop and everything was on full status of great golf and, you know, it seemed easy and simple and in the zone per se?
Yeah, you know, it was just kind of, it was a nice validation for me. I felt like since the end of my senior year in college, you know, I could really just feel my game kind of start to take off a little bit. I was starting to really own some of the stuff that I'd been working on with my coach for the 2 years prior, and everything was really starting to feel good. I played really well at the end of my college career in my last semester, and to kind of take the fall off a little bit of golf, I had to finish up some school, and it kind of gave me a nice mental break, and I went right down and played well in the Latin American Q School and really played well all up until that win. And then that win just really validated for me that, you know, I have gotten a lot better in the last year and a half. And so, and that, I mean, if you can win on that tour or PGA Tour Canada or even in China, I mean, you can compete and you can win anywhere. So that was really nice to kind of, you know, didn't feel like a monkey off my back because I hadn't really had any events up to that point where I was in, you know, real close contention and didn't get it done. I had played solid, but that was the one where I knew I kind of had my stuff when I showed up that week and had a short week, only practiced on Tuesday and Wednesday down there, had my dad with me and just kind of felt like I knew I had my stuff, played nine holes each day to prepare, and just kind of went out and the hole did look nice and big that first round. But if you ask other guys that played in that event, the greens weren't great that week. So I was really just hitting it exactly where I was looking. I'd never really had a week like that before, but I could just felt like even from driver down to 60 degree, you know, whatever shape I was trying to hit it, wherever I was looking, the ball seemed to end up there. So that was pretty fun. I'd never really played golf with that much command before, and it kind of made me realize how good you actually can play, and kind of made me excited to keep working hard and keep seeing how much better I can get.
There's this trend line in golf where young guys like yourself coming out of college are prepared to win. And the old days, you know, from golfers, let's say, who are in their 50s now, and they got out there and they had to kind of learn, and it seems like a longer process than it is today. And I guess my question is it, what do you think this generation has where you guys go out there, have success pretty early, and essentially it's almost like you're not afraid to win? Is it just a mindset? Is it better instruction early so you guys are more prepared when you come out there? Do you see a reason on kind of every major tour level that there's a bunch of younger guys winning?
Yeah, you know, that's definitely a pattern that we've seen developing the last few years, and I think it's a great question. You know, I think a lot of it has to do with the inventions of stuff like TrackMan and, you know, guys just, there's certain things that before, I believe, you know, it took a lot of time for guys to learn and really understand. And that was, you know, how far each club goes, how they shape different shots. You know, guys kind of back in the day really had ownership of those things, their games. And that took, you know, could sometimes take a couple of years, 5 years even to develop skills like that. But now, you know, kids are using TrackMan from the time they're 13, 14, and they just, that it's really sped up the learning curve with stuff like that. And then also I think college golf has just gotten to a point where my senior year at Ohio State, I think we played four or five major championship golf courses on our schedule that season. And, you know, you go to a top program and you play just these really good golf courses all the time. And I think it just makes the players that much better. I mean, the high level of college golf is, I don't quite think people realize how high of a level it is that is being played out there. It's pretty fun to be a part of. And it's fun even now just to, I mean, NCAA is on Golf Channel has turned into one of the much watched golf events for me of the year. I think that's just one of the coolest things out there. And, you know, I think it's also just, it's the guys that, you know, you've come up with, like guys that have come up and gone through the ranks with Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth, guys like that. I mean, they've played in a bunch of tournaments with them and they've probably beat them a bunch of times. Like you start to realize that, okay, I mean, I've played in junior tournaments with this kid for 8 years and he just won on tour. Like there's no reason why I can't win on tour. And I think it just kind of becomes infectious a little bit with guys, and especially a lot of these younger guys. Like, you know, you see your peers and you see guys that you know how they do certain things and how they've come up through the ranks, and you see them get it done like that, especially in majors now, and you're like, wow, guys are really starting to realize, like, okay, you know, it's not, I don't need to come out here and grind my teeth and get to know the courses for 5 years. Like, he won, so I can win. And I think that's just kind of developed and is really manifesting itself right now.
That, and it looks like, you know, your generation just doesn't have any fear. You just, you know, you take it on, you know, you play aggressive. Guys are all super long. Like, it just seems like there's a different mindset where it's just you guys are going to, when the opportunity is there, you guys are going to seize that opportunity, which I think it's cool to watch these young guys kind of, you know, your generation, the guys who are 22 to say 29, you know, those guys are, they're starting to dominate the tour with what, I don't know, did you ever play against Bryson at all during your college career?
Yeah, I played against him a lot. Right. I have a couple buddies that are really close with him, and it's been really cool to see what he's done.
Yeah, but it's just, once again, the learning curve, it seems to be, like you were saying, it's shorter. You know, he's out there, and then if there's an opportunity to win, there's no fear, there's no back down, he just plays hard. It seems like that, from afar, is your generation of how you guys play, and I think it's a great way to play golf, of fearless mentality and play aggressive and know, you know, if the opportunity is there, take advantage of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you were talking about working with TrackMan, and this question came in from somebody who listens to our podcast, and they wanted me to ask you about the years you have worked at TPS with John Perna and kind of what that school and that teaching has brought to your game.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I've been working with him, we're going on about 8 or so years now. That was since my sophomore year in high school, and he had just, for the first probably year or 2 years, he hadn't even had a track man yet. They were still kind of just on tune and hard to get and super expensive. They still are super expensive, but there's more of them around now. When we first started messing around with it, there was a certain learning curve everyone had to overcome with TrackMan that took about 2 or 3 years of what really understanding what the numbers meant, what exactly they were showing you, how to really use it efficiently. When it first came out, a lot of people were, kind of using it, didn't really know what the information was telling you, and it was definitely, in certain cases, probably creating more problems than fixing them. But he has done an unbelievable job at, working with the people that have invented it, and he's certified, I think, the highest you can get is TrackMan Master or something, and he has that, he knows that thing in and out, and I think there were some positional stuff we wanted to do to my swing in college that we got accomplished, and since we've knocked that out, definitely our focus has gone more towards, TrackMan and seeing certain launch numbers and flight numbers, carry numbers that we want to see, and it's really helped, and just I pretty much trust them with everything in my game. We've kind of built it all from the ground up since I was in high school. So it's fun to work with them.
Is there any other teaching philosophies that they have that is sort of unique or anything that you think differentiates besides using TrackMan or whatever technology is available and is going to keep progressing that makes working with him in that school, really beneficial to you?
I think just one of, my favorite parts of what he teaches and his philosophies are, you hear a lot of people talk about, got to have your fundamentals down, grip, stance, balance, that kind of stuff. And where he kind of starts is the main fundamental we're always looking for, is we just kind of look at your ball flight as a fundamental. Like if the ball's doing what you are visualizing and what you want to see it do in the air, and that's all you kind of need to have. And you can kind of work backwards from there. So, it's easy to get into certain schools of thought and say, okay, I want to have my club in this position and do this and that, but it doesn't really matter where that stuff is. If the ball is doing what you want it to do, everyone kind of has a different natural motion they make at it. And especially if someone's been playing since they were 5 or 6, it's pretty tough to really go in there and change a bunch of things. So we just kind of work backwards from ball flight, and we've created kind of some cool rules and little flow charts and stuff, what we think needs to be adjusted or worked on based on what the ball flight looks like and what the launch numbers are looking like. And that's probably been the biggest help this year, because we've really gotten where we feel like some of the stuff is getting where we want to see it, and now we can kind of play around and experiment a little bit and see how far we can really take it.
Also, I've had a few of the younger professionals on the podcast, and just talking to them about essentially learning how to travel. I mean, you're talking about your fall schedule is going to be, it's going to be busy. How long does that learning curve take, and I'm paraphrasing here, to essentially understand how to travel and travel like a professional, and how much you can push and when you need some time off, and just that whole rhythm of doing it? Does it come fairly, is it quick, or is it something that takes some time to get adjusted to when you guys are on the road as much as you are with different time zones and everything that you're doing?
It definitely is something that takes a little getting adjusted to. And I think that's one of the best parts about PGA Tour Latino America, especially coming out of college. I mean, it was in college, you don't have to think about anything. Your coach tells you where to be, when to be there, and you just show up and everything's planned out for you and thought out for you. You kind of just flip it in cruise control and go along for the ride. But starting out in Latin America, I think I went to Q school in Bogota, which was a 3-hour flight from Miami. That's pretty easy. But then the first 2 week stretch I went on was straight down to Buenos Aires, and then from Buenos Aires to Guatemala, which was, I had to take a 10.5 hour red eye flight to Mexico City and then get on a 3 hour connection from there to Guatemala. I mean, it was, I felt like I was on an episode of The Amazing Race. It was pretty insane. But just kind of going through some of those growing pains, you just have to learn through experience. And I kind of learned last year, like, okay, if I'm going to go out and it's really going to be some international travel and some long flights, about 3 weeks in a row is what I have in me. I can definitely do more and push it more, but if I really want to feel like my game's where it needs to be at to win and to really compete, 3 weeks is a nice time for me to be down there. And then, you know, you got to come home and take a little time off. And those numbers completely change when you're talking about traveling domestically versus internationally. I could be on the road in the States for 8 or 10 weeks pretty easily and not think much about it. But there's just certain, you know, things when you're going down, especially to South America, that you have to think of that, you know, are a little different than here in the U.S. But I think, yeah, that's why Latin America is such an awesome tour, because you really learn how to travel. You pretty much are starting out your career on about as hard as you can get, travel-wise, especially getting used to different grasses every week, different climates. We're in the mountains 1 week, and then we're in a rainforest in Costa Rica the next. I mean, you're playing in completely different conditions from week to week, which is a huge factor as well. And I think now it's done so much for me, because a three-hour flight here or there seems like nothing. You know, it's I can get on the plane, I know how to make my body feel good, and it's pretty easy. Compared to, you know, a bunch of 9 and 8 hour flights last year. So that was definitely something I was worried about when I turned pro, and there was a little bit of growing pains last year with that. But after that experience, it's helped me so much, and I wouldn't trade that experience really for anything.
Of the countries you kind of visited in Central America and South America, is there any that you just fell in love with? And then on the flip side, was there any great stories where you were like, oh my God, I can't believe I am in this position, sleeping here in this region, or is it all actually great spots to you know, to go play professional golf at?
A lot of amazing places. I think I've only been to Bogota, but the Colombia is an amazing country. I think Colombia gets a bad rap about it, and especially shows like Narcos and stuff like that have shed some light on some of the stuff that goes on down there. But Colombia is an amazing place. I felt so safe. I spent 2 weeks in Bogota. I felt so safe every day I was there. You know, we could walk to dinner at night at 9 o'clock and there was no problems. Really good food, great people. You know, you're up in the mountains. It's got a nice climate to it. That was a really cool spot. Costa Rica, we played right on the ocean on the west coast of Costa Rica. That was amazing. Nicaragua, very similar. We were in there's a really famous surf break not far where we were from. So I guess a lot of surfers would know, but Guasalito was the part of Nicaragua we were in, and that was spectacular. That is also kind of piggybacks on the second part of your question there. That tournament was Thursday to Sunday, and we were going to San Luis Potosi the next week in Mexico. So we get, we had a shuttle Monday morning from this resort that was about 2 or 3 hours from the main city of Nicaragua, which is Managua, the airport you fly out of. And that shuttle ride is one that made you think about where you're at and what you're doing a little bit, because it was about 5 in the morning and it was 3 hours on roads that had never even seen what pavement looks like. I mean, just holes everywhere. And there was an ox that walked right by our bus we were in, pulling a big wheelbarrow of like grass and hay and fruits and stuff. And I was like, what is going on here? I'd never seen an ox in person before, let alone, you know, carrying around produce like they did, you know, way back in the day around here. So that was it just really made you think about where we were, and, you know, definitely a lot of the places down there make you realize how lucky we are to, you know, be from the United States and all the opportunities we have here. But so many of the places are just so, so gorgeous and places you'd never really think to go on vacation. But once you get there, you're like, wow, this place is unbelievable. And a lot of cities I probably never would have visited if not for the tour and the tournament. So it was really cool.
Well, I also know you come from quite a golfing family. I'm assuming there was probably a golf club in your hand when you just started walking around. So if you can tell our listeners the history of your mom had a really great career, and your dad can play, and your brother's looks like he's going to be an aspiring professional. So how's the family dynamic at this point of who's the best player, and then, you know, just kind of how you got started playing the game?
Yeah, my mom's father was pretty involved with golf in the Chicagoland area. He was on the WGA board and, you know, did a ton of stuff with the majors at Medina in 75 and 90. And so she got super into it through that. She played college at the University of Tulsa, and they won the national championship there in 1988. And she played in two U.S. Women's Opens when she was in college. And she didn't quite want to go pro or try to do that whole deal for various reasons. But she, I was just introduced to the game when I was really young. And there was never any pressure from my parents really to pursue golf or have that be my thing. I played every sport under the sun growing up, and just realized at about, you know, 11 or 12 that I would always try to skip other sports or try to get out of tournaments early and stuff so I could go play golf or squeeze golfing on the weekends. And a lot of that had to do with Tiger Woods. He was just my hero growing up. But yeah, I kept playing other sports probably till about 15 or 16. And then really just went all in with golf. And yeah, we have a cool family dynamic with it. We go on golf trips all the time. It's where a lot of our breaks are centered around. It's perfect. We have a nice family foursome. We mix up the teams a little bit, and there's some silent dinners on our golf trips. It gets pretty competitive, and there's a lot of trash talking going on out there. And I know probably about every caddy we've ever had on a golf trip has said you're the best group we've ever had, just because my mom gets up to her tees and smokes one 250 down the middle and starts talking trash to me and my brother from the first tee to the 18th green. So it's a lot of fun, and we have a blast with it, but it's not all fun and games at points. It gets pretty competitive, which can be pretty fun.
How's your brother's game coming around, and does he have aspirations to follow your footsteps and go pro?
Yeah, you know, I tell everybody he's absolutely more naturally talented at golf than I am. I mean, he could not play for 2 or 3 weeks and step out of the car and not hit a ball in the range and go to the first tee and fly one 330 in the air and just stripe it right down the middle. His ability to hit the golf ball is something I'm jealous of every single day I play with him. And he, you know, he's thinking about it. He played a little bit this summer, got playing in some tournaments again. And I think every time he caddies for me in an event, it sparks a little more of a fire under him to see if he can do it and give it a shot. And so we'll see where he's at in about a year or two once he's done with college. He's kind of thought about dipping his toes in the whole long drive scene too, because he hits it a mile by me. I can't even fathom how far he hits the ball, but he's got some just freakish natural talent in that part of the game. So we'll see where it goes and just kind of let him make that decision whenever he feels comfortable with it. He's kind of been hot and cold with golf a few times in his life. So we'll see. We all know he has the ability and the talent to do it, but we'll just see, you know, if he really thinks it's something he wants to pursue.
Well, growing up in Wheaton, which is not far from where I'm at in Sycamore, some of the courses we probably have all played as well. But, you know, for your family and when you were growing up in that Wheaton area, what courses did you guys usually end up playing at, or were you guys members anywhere? And then where's sort of your home base now when you're in Chicago, when you're not traveling?
So the first conscious memory I have on a golf course is at Mill Creek. Grew up going, that's when I graduated from the plastic set around the house, and we got some real clubs, and I would go out to Mill Creek with my parents and go to the little pitch and putt course they had and just play it two or three times and just have a blast doing it. And then I think really where I first realized I really loved the game and could just play all day, every day, was at the Cantina Youth Links when I was about, end of elementary school. I would go to, they had boys club on Mondays, and my parents would drop me off at 7 a.m. I'd always have the first tee time with my buddies, something I'm still to this day, love the first tee time, but go to the first tee time and they'd pick me up. Both my parents worked when I was growing up, so a lot of the times in the summer, it was just drop me off before work and pick me up after work. So I'd be there from 7 a.m. to 4:30, 5 p.m. every Monday, and probably eat about 6 to 8 hot dogs and have 8 Mountain Dews and annoy the people that were working there. But it was a blast doing that. And that's when I really, the first time I was really bummed I couldn't golf was my mom. I was supposed to water the flowers one day when my parents were at York, and I didn't. And my mom knew right when she came home, and they wouldn't let me go the next day. And that just absolutely cried. I just remember sitting, I was probably 9 or 10, but I still remember this day sitting in my house knowing that my buddies were out playing and that I was not at home, and or that I was at home, and that it just crushed me. And that's kind of when I think I started to realize that, you know, I love playing golf. It's just something I'd love to do. That's never left me. I still feel the same way about it today.
And what's your home base now that you practice out of when you're in Chicago?
Yeah, so I grew up out at Medina. My mom grew up out there as well. And just this summer, I turned 24. So it was the year for me to join as an associate member, which I did. So I'm now a fourth generation member out there in my family, which has been pretty cool for my parents and grandparents that, you know, it's, we all just remember it was yesterday when I was playing junior club championship and stuff. And now that I'm actually a member, it's pretty cool for all of us. But yeah, I grew up playing there pretty much every day in the summer besides Mondays. I would be at the youth links with my buddies.
And yeah, what great practice facilities. And I mean, you know, assuming the weather is great in Chicago for the spring and summer, whatnot, that's gotta be a perfect place to hone your game, especially if you can get on 3 when you want to. And, you know, number 2 looks really good now out there. So what a great facility to you know, practice and get better.
Yeah, I mean, I was extremely lucky being able to grow up out there. And, you know, with all the people we know out there, and we had quite the junior golf program when I came up to there. We had John Callahan, who played at Northwestern, Danny Stringfellow, who's still playing pro. He played at Auburn. We had a guy go to Boston College that was around my age, a little older than me. We've got some of the kids that were a little younger than me at Michigan State and NIU now. So we've had all, as you know, I mean, it's an awesome golf course. So we all had a great place to grow up, but there's been quite a few college and professional golfers that have come out of there. So it's been a fun breeding ground of thousands around there. And yeah, it's a great place now to come back in the summer. And, you know, I really feel like I can kind of get any work done I need to out there. Lucky to have that set up for sure.
So you're playing golf through high school, and obviously you're doing quite well with it because you play golf at Ohio State University. Was that decision an easy decision? How many other colleges were sort of in the running? And with such a great history of, you know, golfers at Ohio State, did you ever get to meet any of the legends that played there beforehand? You know, Nicklaus, John Cook. I mean, the list goes on. You know, how did that come about, and how was that time there, and how were the influence from the guys, you know, who were before you on your career when you were there?
Absolutely. There was a lot of other colleges that I considered and kind of talked to here and there, but the final two it came down to were Illinois and Ohio State. I knew I wanted to be I didn't want to go to school in my backyard, really, but I wanted to be close enough to home where I felt like I was still getting the kind of Midwest feel and Midwest people. I knew a couple guys that were going to schools down south, and I thought about it a little bit, checked a few of them out, but just the I wasn't really sure I wanted to immerse myself in that environment. You know, I just really love the Midwestern kind of rhythm and way of life, and, you know, I wanted to be around those people in college. So went on a visit to Ohio State, and I just immediately fell in love with it. The football game, just the athletic program, what I felt like it meant to be an athlete at Ohio State, weighed in my decision heavily. Really got along with the coach who recruited me there, Donnie Dar, and you know, the facilities were awesome. We built an unbelievable indoor facility while I was there that I got to use for my last 3 years. And yeah, I've met John Cook quite a few times. Joey Sindelar's son was there the year before I got there, but he was finishing up school my freshman year, so I got to know Jamie pretty well. There was a I only met Mr. Nicholas one time, and that was my senior year on spring break. He was never around that much, but did get to pick his brain for about 20 minutes, which was pretty cool. But yeah, I mean, there's just the history there is awesome. The Scarlet course is as hard as you'd want a golf course to be. It was a great place to play every day. And yeah, it was just really cool just to be, you know, an athlete at Ohio State. It was everything I dreamed of when I was a kid, when I wanted to play a sport in college, and wouldn't trade my time there for anything. It was an awesome experience.
Are there any of the Chicago golfers, the Lou Donalds, I'm thinking like Jeff Sluman, Chip Beck, any of those other guys who kind of, you know, been around this area, influenced you as well, or kind of taken you under your wing? Who else am I thinking of? Mark Wilson. I mean, there's quite a few of them that kind of have a history here.
Yeah, I haven't met that many of them. I know, well, I went to the same high school as Kevin Streelman, so I definitely talked to him a couple times when I was younger high school type years. I haven't really reconnected with him since, but he's been, you know, it's cool to, in the tournaments he's been contending in and stuff, to, you know, watch his group tee off and hear Wheaton, Illinois called. You just always feel like you have a sense of connection to someone that's from the same hometown as you, not even Chicago, the same suburb. So that's been cool. You know, I'd love to kind of, I know some people at NOMO. I'd love to get in contact with them, maybe play with them a couple times this winter and just be able to pick his brain a little bit. Yeah, he's definitely been kind of an inspiration for me around the area to look up to when I was coming up.
Well, and another influence that has entered the mix of golf in 2018, I think we both find this man quite fascinating, Ho-Sung Choi.
Yeah.
There is some, yeah, I mean, flair in fashion like I have not seen. Also, you know, some swagger, just a little bit of it. Can you comment on this man's greatness, and what do you find so fascinating about this man of mystery from the Far East playing the Asian Tour?
I mean, honest to God, that is probably the most golf I've watched in one sitting this summer, were the three rounds I watched him play in the Korean Open. We were playing cards in my basement one night, just had Golf Channel on as I usually do, just in the background. And all of a sudden this Korean Open comes on and we're like, oh, what's this? And it was the second round. It wasn't even the weekend yet. And we saw this guy and I was like, the first time I saw him hit a ball, like he was playing pretty good. I was like, wow, that had to be a crazy lie, or well, I don't know what's going on. And then we watched the end of that round. He was in like fourth place or something. And I knew, and I think I took one of the videos, and I knew he was playing the next day. No, this was the day. So I took the video on Saturday night, or maybe it was Friday night because they were so far ahead, whatever. I took the video on the third round and then watched for about 2 hours, watched his entire back nine that round, watched every shot. I have never seen a golfer where I am more glued to the TV. I had to see every shot he was hitting because every single shot had something unique or different to it. I didn't care if it was a chip just off the green. He would do something crazy when it was in the air, or do something that just drew you to the TV and made you want to watch it. I've watched even guys like Dustin Johnson shoot 24 under before and haven't been half as interested as I was watching him grind out like a 2 under par. I mean, it was unbelievable. I really wish he would have think you need to finish in the top four or something for that British Open spot. It would have been pretty cool to see him play the British this summer. But I did just see a couple weeks ago that he had another good finish. So he's climbing the money list on the Asian Tour right now. So who knows? I mean, he just has one of the greatest backstories I've probably ever heard from a professional golfer too, which is pretty cool. It was just, I mean, I've been around golf a long time. I've watched a lot of people hit golf balls, and I don't know if there's been very few that have taken my breath away on the first swing like he did. It was unbelievable.
The body language with the driver of him, like, willing this thing to draw or fade was just fantastic. I'm with you. Like, my wife is literally sleeping. I'm in bed, like, up at, like, whatever it was, 2 in the morning, because I want this guy to win so bad. Like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. Like, I can't believe, and I've been around golf my entire life, you know, Cedric's, have I not seen this guy before? And, oh, yeah. I mean, I think anyone who loves golf was fascinated with watching this performance. It was priceless. It really was, like, it was fun to watch. Like, I was rooting for him to win, but, you know, he didn't get it done. But, man, he got a lot of publicity out of it, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I think just, I played with a guy in the Colombian Monday qualifier who played a lot, who mainly plays in, you know, his world ranking was all the way up to like 90 or something. This guy I played with, I'm kind of blanking on his, I want to say it was maybe Seng Shu Han or something along those lines. He had played the Web about 6 years ago, but he played really good in the Dominican Republic. So he has a bunch of FedEx Cup points. He's 90th in the world. So he was kind of coming over here to play some Mondays, try to get into another event, you know, to see if he could get that status up, or because if you get a certain amount of points, you become a special member. I don't know how that all works, but he told me that he plays most of his golf on the Asian Tour and Japanese Tour. And I was like, oh, really? And I think I proceeded to ask him about only Ho-Sung Choi for the next 5 holes. And I could tell by about 16, this guy just did not want to talk to me anymore. So I kind of let off of it a little bit, but that guy, he fascinates me pretty much in every facet of the game. I can't really wrap my head around it. And I don't know if you've tried or anybody who's listening has tried, but to actually do what he does on a driver is very hard to do. To make contact anywhere on the face, on your toes, and like falling to the side like that, and then walk all the way to the edge of the tee box and look over your shoulder, like, It just must be something that's so natural to him, or just that his positions are in such a way where that's the only way he can functionally hit the ball. But, I mean, I've been really trying to hit drivers like that for about 2 months now, and I can't hit one that looks even remotely close to how he does it. It is fascinating.
Yeah, golf is difficult enough, let alone, you know, me at 45 years old trying to be Fred Astaire after, you know, God forbid I make solid contact. No, I've never, like I said, I've never seen anything like it. But I'm with you on, you know, if he can be in a major in 2019, I'm glued to watching. I don't care if he's 20 over par, you know, halfway through round 2 at the Open or something. I'm watching it. It's great stuff.
I mean, they need to put, he needs to be in one of these silly season events and like the HSBC or...
Oh, how great would that be, right?
Or one of the ones in the state, you know, one of the fall series events that, you know, I'm not going to pretend like I know how all this stuff in the industry works, but if I were a tournament director and I saw just the social media footprint and the traction that the Korean Open was drawing that weekend, just from people tweeting and talking about it, I mean, everybody knew who this guy was after that weekend. You know, everybody.
I'm trying to think, like, you could put him in the Shark Shootout or something, and then, like, who could you pair him up with that would just be, like, the most fascinating pairing of him and, like, if you could
Bubba
find...
Watson would be the two craziest golfers you'd ever see in your life.
There you go, right? You would, I mean, who would not watch that for a team event of the footwork of those two guys just basting it everywhere? Like, that would, there you go. That would be so good. I'd watch that over the Tiger Phil made-for-TV event. I mean, I think that'd be more fascinating.
Yeah, or we need Ho-Sung as an undercard at that event.
Oh, there you, yeah, right? there you go. Have him play somebody else like Hideki or something like that. Like, bring that, you know, demographic in of, you know, fans from the Far East and, like, have them have a match, like an undercard. I mean, you should go in golf promotions. This would be perfect. Well, if he's on it, I'm watching it. Also, from your golf commentating perspective, Ryder Cup coming up, and picks were made today, so... Thoughts on the Ryder Cup upcoming? Thoughts on the picks? What's, you know, you're a professional golfer. What's sort of your perception of kind of what happened of the picks on both sides and assessment of the teams?
Yeah, I think for the USA, the first three picks are exactly who, you know, everyone thought it was going to be for the last 2 weeks probably. And I think Bryson's last 2 weeks only made that more of a no-brainer. A lot of people I've been talking to, you know, around the club and stuff, they're talking to me about Phil and how they could get the same benefit from Phil as an assistant captain as a player. The Ryder Cup's one of those things, you've seen it with Ian Poulter, that it just, and I don't really buy into the current form that much as well. I think Phil, he's a guy, he's played, what is this, his 12th in a row?
Yeah, it's
or something
crazy.
Like that. It doesn't matter how he's playing that the whole year leading up to it or whatever. He's going to flip on a different switch. He's going to get in a different mode, and he's going to show up there to play. And even if he doesn't play that well, if he's playing really bad that week, they're just going to hide him in the lineup, and he might play one of the foursomes or fourball matches and not a singles match. But I don't really think that's going to be the case. But I think even if he loses a point for you in a foursome or fourball match, but I think him being there and being on the team, and I think a big part of it is the lack of narrative of should Phil be here? Like, why isn't he playing? You know, if it starts to go a little bad, you know, that how that whole thing goes. I think it just quiets that down, and it puts the best kind of up-and-coming young guy that wasn't on the team yet in Bryson. Obviously, Tiger's been playing unbelievable golf this season. He's going to play awesome. And then you put Phil in there because he's kind of like the glue guy. He's who the whole team is going to rally around. And he's been in all the situations before in every type of match and every type of upset, you know, that you can think of in the Ryder Cup. And then it kind of goes for me the same thinking on the European side. I think the European team is so good that picking Sergio in one of those spots, it doesn't really hurt him in any way at all. I think you're going to look at their guys 1 through 8 who made the team automatically, that those guys are so good and they've been playing so good this year that having a Matt Wallace or a Matt Fitzpatrick over Sergio isn't going to push the decision one way or the other. It's really not going to be that big of a discrepancy. And then, but then you got Sergio, a guy who's had all the experience. He was on Ryder Cup teams, and he was like 19, I think, back in 99. And he, even though he hasn't been playing that good this year, you only need him for a point or two here and there, so he can easily click into that same mode he was at Hazeltine a couple years ago, and he had that awesome match. So I think, you know, the picks were pretty good, and I'm very interested to see who we take with our fourth pick. I think it could be any of a handful of guys. Finau's obviously a great choice. I think also a guy like Xander Schauffele would be an awesome choice too. It just, down to this point with one pick remaining, I think it just, you got to put the lineups up. You got to see who would be playing with who, and then you just pick a guy that basically fits into your system somewhere where you want him to be, and make the decision that way. But I can't wait. I think this is going to be an awesome Ryder Cup, but I almost think that because it's going to be so awesome, it might be a blowout one way or the other. I hope it's not, but the Americans have been playing some pretty good golf this year. But then again, so have your Molinari's been playing awesome, and obviously their top dogs are as good as any golfers in the world, so it'll be fun to watch.
We had Graham McDowell on earlier this week, and I had a feeling they were going to go with experience, just some kind of reading in between the lines of some of his answers of how important experience was. But I think you're exactly right in the sense that I think they're just taking their big dogs, and they know, has Stenson had a bad year? No. Has it been a great year? No. Will he show up when it really matters? Yeah, probably. Same with Sergio.
Yep.
I mean, there's just too much pedigree there not to take those guys with the younger team that they have, you know, from the guys who qualified. I think it's going to be, I have no idea who's going to win. I would have said a year ago, the American team looks way better, but gosh, the Europeans have been good for the last 6 or 7 months, so.
I know, and it's the whole reason they have those captain's picks is to pick who they want on the team. You know, if everyone felt like it should be you know, it should have been Matt Wallace or Peters or Bayo or someone like that, then they would just make it the top 12 points guys. But they have those two. Does Europe have two picks, or they have less than the States, right?
They have. So he had four captain's picks. Bjorn did.
The Europe. Okay.
Four. And we okay. have so they, four.
So it's the same.
Yeah, we just do ours. You got the Billy Horschel rule for picking the last one later. But essentially, we copied their format after what we have two picks. And it when they had that whole commission, for lack of a better word, they kind of went to give the captain some more leniency to say, hey, look, who's got a hot hand right now? Or exactly what you're talking about, of where do I see the synergies making sense? So, they're but all at four picks.
The reason you have those picks there is so if Sergio doesn't make the team, you can pick them. And there, every year there's going to be those young guys that are really close that just don't get the nod. But honestly, they don't get the nod because they're not Sergio Garcia. Like, there's only a certain amount of guys that can be on the team, and they're going to pick, you know, the guys who have been doing it for, you know, some of those guys have had a good year. Well, Sergio's had 15 years, so it's tough to have to say, hey, just because, you know, this year you might not be playing your best, you're not going to make the team. That's kind of why they have the pick, to give you safety. Because those guys, like Bjorn knows that Sergio could miss 5 weeks in a row, but you give a week off and then the Ryder Cup's coming up, like, he's going to show up to play. You play to the level around you, and it's kind of crazy what the brain can do in certain environments like that and just elevate it. So I think it'll be awesome. Looking forward to it.
Well, talking about your boyhood idol, Tiger Woods, what's sort of your thought on the comeback, where he is at with his game, and as being a, you know, say you're a golfer, even though you're a professional golfer yourself, you're still a fan of him, he's iconic. What's sort of your take on the progression he's made this season?
Man, I've been the biggest Tiger optimist every single comeback from, you know, it felt like 2013 until it seemed like there was six or seven of them, but never in my wildest dreams that he could be playing the golf this fast again. I mean, what happened the last two majors here, I mean, he was in contention the entire week. His iron game is unbelievable. I saw something that said since strokes gained has been a stat, the worst to ever finish a season in strokes gained approach has been fourth this year, which is it's a mind stat, because if you're hitting your approach second, I mean, it's really hard not contend and be in the mix in golf tournaments. And I think that the level of golf he's stood up and played this year, and now if he actually has an off this year that he's actually going to be healthy for, and that he can actually work on stuff that he feel like needs attention. People are, you know, we're wanting the driver to be better from one week to another. You can tweak little things, but there's not much you can do to change entire patterns from a week to week basis. But if he can get back to wherever he's living at now, Jupiter or wherever there, and have 3 months where he's going to maybe play the Hero in there, maybe play Dubai or something. Those are just one off weeks though, but he actually has 3 months where he can be like, okay, this is what I want to attack in my game right now. And he actually has a healthy body to do that. Ooh, it could be, I mean, we'll see where it goes, but it could be special. And I think after watching what he did this year, I think that the numbers had at least, for me personally, at least more majors now. I'd have to think he's going to win. I mean, he almost won two this year. And so you got to think he's going to have a couple more majors like this year where it looks like he could win, but just it's someone else's week. But I also think there's going to be at least two and where he's going to have a little better first round and going to have that one round where stuff's really dropping and he's locked in, and it's just going to be the first week of September, I already can't wait for him to play Augusta next year, because he has been Augusta at least 6 years now with the game that he showed this year. And I think in that 6 years, he still has had two top tens in that time. That's just good. If he can go to that place and finish 10 with a makeshift body and, you know, 2 weeks of hitting balls before, what he can do with a year of PGA Tour level golf under his belt again, it could be, we could be on the verge of something pretty special right now. And I'm just, every time he plays, I'm on my phone for 4.5 hours watching every shot. You know, I can't get enough of it. It's just so much fun to watch him play really good again.
Yeah, it's fun to have him back. The way he's doing it, too, of smiling and having a little bit more fun with it, it's a little bit different Tiger. But I think 19 could be a really – I mean, he's starting to – the driver's starting to work for him. The tempo looks better, and he's still pounding it. I think get through this year, and it's been very solid. Wait till 19. Like you said, he's got – he can trust his body, put the work in. It's going to be interesting to watch. Well, I've got a few more here for you. They're kind of quick hitters, and we'll get you out of here. So whatever just kind of comes to your mind on these last ones here. So we got to take Medina out of this, but best golf courses in Chicagoland besides Medina, like the top two or three you've played, and what makes those courses so great?
Easiest one that comes to mind first, right in my hometown here, Chicago Golf. That place is very special, and it's, you know, probably been made a little more special in my head that fact that it's I'm in our office right now in front of our house, and I'm looking at tabs. I could probably hit 4 drivers from our front and be somewhere on the property. It's just right on the other side of this park we live by. And the fact that it's right there, and I've only been out there, I think I've played there 5 times total. But I mean, it's just, if someone blindfolded me and dropped me on the middle of that property, even having grown up in Wheaton my entire life and someone asked me where I was, I would never say I was in the middle of suburbia Chicago. I mean, there's something about the trees on the edge of the property. If they're just big enough, or that the property is just big enough, I don't know what it is, but when you're there playing golf, you truly feel like you could be anywhere in the country. It's a really, and then you pull the gates, take a left-hand turn. It's a street I drove to high school every day. It's like, well, we're right in the middle of a pretty big group here. I just think that's really cool. I'm trying to think of, well, Skokie, I think, is awesome. Played there my freshman year of college in the Westerns event. That was just an awesome golf course. Just the shot value out there, and every hole is a little different. You know, it's not, you don't feel like you're playing the same hole over and over again. Just a really cool place. I would say probably my favorite day of golf experience in Chicago would have to be Butler National. Just going out there, eating in the locker room, playing with caddies, and golf course just always in perfect condition. And it's brutally hard. I would love, and it'll never happen, but a U.S. Open at a place like that would be so much fun to watch. The pros love that place too.
Well, it wouldn't be hard to have it out there. I mean, it's basically set up like a major all the time. The times I've been out there playing.
Yeah, and just the infrastructure around the property too. I mean, it doesn't get much easier than that. But yeah, I mean, those are probably 3 answers that a lot of people will give you. But I think it's hard to really go off that path. Of those 3 golf courses. The one caveat I will say is I've never played Shore Acres, so.
Fantastic. It's awesome.
I've heard it's Chicago golf with even a little better topography and land, so.
It's different.
I've never had the opportunity to get out there.
It's different. The topography is different than Chicago. I love Chicago golf too, for the record. I mean, it's iconic. It's got every template hole. It feels like you're out east with the whole ambiance. Shore Acres is a different piece of property, but you can still feel the Seth Rayner influence, right? I mean, you got to go out to play Shore Acres. It's that good. And they've redone it and took some trees out, so it's got a little bit more width. And I don't think it's quite as difficult from the backs as Chicago can be with the green complexes and whatnot. But, oh, man, it is so good. It's so good. The other one, too, is Old Elm. I don't know if you ever played that.
I've not played that one either. Heard awesome things, particularly from Andy Johnson about that one. He loves that place. And I know we kind of were a little inspired by Old Elm with what we had done to course 2 recently at Medina, with getting kind of the the approach areas and stuff to roll right into bunkers and kind of have greens that come right up to the bunker's edge now. But I've heard that place is awesome. And I will say, one place that I'd never heard of before we played a tournament there, Northwestern, I think it was my senior year right there, Lakeshore, is an awesome golf course.
I lost you there. Which course was it?
Lakeshore.
I've heard it's great. I've not played it. I've heard it's great.
Yeah. So that is there. You know, there's North Shore, Lakeshore, all those, but it is Lakeshore. There, the clubhouse that they have across the street, it's not, they have like kind of a golf clubhouse with the pro shop and locker room and everything. But then they have their main clubhouse across the street with the pool. And it is right on Lake Michigan. It is unbelievable. Feel like you're in the Hamptons almost when you're there. I mean, there's just this old looking, historically, you know, architect-looking building that just is right on the lake, and big pool that goes almost out to the lake. It's a cool spot.
So as a follow-up to this, you know, we're lucky in Chicagoland. They do have some great golf courses, some great old private clubs with history. And you know, there's kind of this talk of golf architecture. And so in your opinion, from a design standpoint, what makes a really great golf course and what makes a bad golf course? In your opinion, and you know, thank goodness that, in my opinion, the architecture of late has been to kind of go back to more of the stuff that I think is good, but I wouldn't mind getting your opinion on that.
Yeah, so I think that's an awesome question. I think exactly a question a lot of people have. And so what I think is by far the best architectural golf course I've ever played in a tournament on was last year in Rio de Janeiro. The Olympic course is probably by far the best architectural golf course I've ever played a tournament on. And I think what made it that was the fact that there was room out there, but you had to be careful about where you were putting yourself. Like, you're really, really thinking on every single shot. And we had different wind directions every day. And a lot of courses, you're like, oh, this hole's downwind today. Well, now nothing's in play. I'm just going to blast driver up by the green or as far as I can get it up there or the wind. Like, oh, I guess I'm just going to hit my driver a little lower and I might have a little more club in. Like out here was, oh, the first hole's downwind today. Well, the bunker that I was worried about carrying is not in play. But now there's this other bunker way up there that is making my fairway half the size because if I hit it at it, it's going to run into it. But then if that holds into the wind, all of a sudden that bunker I was talking about the day before, I have to take a line because I can't cover that bunker now. And every hole out there was like that. There'd be some holes with crosswinds. I was like, I'm going to hit it way left here. This fairway's huge. I'm going to go down the far left side because if I'm on the right side with this crosswind, I have no chance at like hitting it within 50 feet of this flag. If I'm way over here to the left, it's like a significantly easier shot because all of a sudden the contours on the greens are now helping me get that ball in the hole. So that tournament was just so much fun for me to play because we had different little winds every day, and it was really like, you'd have to get on every tee and make sure you had good notes and had some understanding of golf architecture, I felt like, to make the right decision and to pull the right clubs off of tees and, you know where the pins were before you were playing the hole, because if you didn't look and you got up there, you could be in a bad spot. I mean, it was just, so I would say, to answer your question, a golf course that really makes you, that you almost have to think of from the green backwards. You're not starting with the tee shot or anything. You're thinking about, okay, where is this pin on this hole and how am I going to play this hole because that pin is there? And you kind of work back from the green complex to the tee box versus, you know, oh, I'm on the tee. Oh, what's it to cover that dog leg or what's it to cut that corner? Okay, boom, you know, just plug and play and just do that all day. No, I think a great golf course is, all right, well, I know that because this pin is in this part of the green, this is now no longer a birdie hole. I'm going to rethink my strategy because I know what I'm trying to do. It doesn't matter if I have a 7-iron or a wedge in, I'm putting in the same spot of the green. So I might take a little bit of risk out of a tee shot. So, yeah, I think that's kind of what a great golf course is, somewhere where you have to think your way from the green back.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that's links golf at some level, right? And it's, I think that's why this renaissance and golden age architecture to have some width off the tee and variety of shots to hit, and it changes every day. I think it's a great thing for golf. I think it's much better than the let's make every golf course look like a U.S. Open and make it 470 yards and tree line really heavy and no options but to pound it, put it in the section of the green, hope you have an uphill putt. I think where it's going of recognizing how good that architecture was in that era, and then building like what they're doing at Sand Valley of, you know, I don't know if you've been up there to play, but to give options and exactly what you're saying from the green backwards and using wind to influence how you play the hole. I think it's such a wonderful way to play golf.
Yeah, and I think it's enjoyable for, it can be enjoyable for everybody.
Exactly, right, versus forced carries and in stuff where a 15 handicap would have no chance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, the last question I have, this is also quite important, white golf belts. I think I listened to a podcast you were on a while ago, and you were lamenting about white golf belts, I think probably even over a year ago. I'm still seeing them out on tour. I'm bothered by it a little bit. Are you still bothered by the white belt scenario being in play in 2018?
Yes, I am. And after saying that, I will be the first to admit that when I was in middle school and high school, I had my fair share of white belts, and I had a lot of them. There was a time where white belt was the only belt I even considered wearing when I was dressing to go play golf. But then I think I realized, like, all right, that doesn't look that good. But there was definitely a time, it was when Jaberg, that company, was blowing up.
Yeah.
And they had their white belts with the big JL buckle. I mean, I had one. I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. And I wore that thing every single day. And, they just don't look good now. And as I've gotten older, I've realized that just a brown belt looks way better. It really doesn't bother me when I see a guy wearing a white belt with white pants and a belt at least matches the color of the pants. I think that's because when you're wearing white pants and you're wearing like a light colored shirt, I could like wearing a black or brown belt could look a little awkward sometimes. I think especially with the Nike stuff, like they did a good job at, they match the pants color exactly to the belt color. You know, I've seen a lot of guys wearing like the vanilla colored pants with the same color belt. That was a big thing at the British Open. Those don't really bother me that much. But yeah, when I see him wearing like a red shirt and black pants, he's wearing a white belt, it's just, I don't get it. It just looks so bad.
I'm assuming your sponsor for your clothing company at Linksoul is not telling you, hey, let's put the white belt with this together and you're going to look great. Like, I think it's like 4 years ago, like it was just sort of over. Like, you have to kind of...
It was over, yeah. It was definitely over like 4 years ago, but people are still holding on to it. All the power to them. That just won't be... I won't be flying that flag anymore.
No, I'm with you. I'm darker colors, and it was a period of time 10 years ago, but I'm going more traditional. So I'm glad we're on the same page about the whole white belt thing on tour. I'm surprised how much I still see it, but I'm glad you're carrying the flag of more natural earth tone colors with the belts to coincide with the outfit. I think it's a better look at this juncture. So
yeah, especially on tour. I mean, they have guys out there every week with different leather companies and stuff. Those guys can get any golf product they want under the sun, yet they're still showing up with some pretty atrocious looking white belts. I don't know. I guess if they're still doing it, some guys must like the look, so all the power to them.
Yeah, maybe, but it's like they play well with it or something, right? Like,
yeah.
Good luck belt.
Who knows? I mean, golf are weird enough with that, so that wouldn't surprise me at all.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. Truly enjoyed the conversation. We'll be watching everything that's happening this fall, and best of luck with your travels and play. And yeah, it's going to be exciting to watch your career, you know, hopefully blossom to everything you want it to be. So I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me on. I really enjoyed it.